Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Ethan Elkind. Tomorrow is the day many have been waiting for, the 2018 midterm elections. Billed as a nationwide referendum on Donald Trump's Republican Party and his own divisive leadership, the results will directly impact the next 2 years of his term in office. So, will Democrats be able to flip the U.S. House of Representatives? Much of that depends on California, where 7 of the 23 seats needed to upend a Republican-led Congress are on the line. Voters will also decide on a slew of state and Bay Area races and ballot measures, including a new governor, rent control, and whether to repeal the gas tax, among others. So tonight we explore the biggest decisions facing California voters tomorrow on Election Day. Joining me here in the studio to talk about these issues is Ben Trefney, news director right here at Local Public Radio, KALW. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks a lot, Ethan.
And also joining me is former Republican strategist Sean Walsh, principal at Wilson Walsh George Ross Consulting. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Jason McDaniel, associate professor of political science at San Francisco State University. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation, and we'll open up those phone lines in just about 20 minutes. The number to dial in is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment on our website, kalw.org, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionskalw. Well, first, Jason McDaniel, let me start with you. What are we seeing so far in terms of voter turnout? So before we get to any of the issues here, what have we seen in terms of the vote-by-mail ballots, you know, the demographics, the polling data, all that? What are we seeing here?
Well, the signals all year have been that Democratic voters especially have been very excited, a lot of expectations for high turnout. We've also seen in recent weeks Republicans start to express similar enthusiasm. What we've seen is right now over 35 million people have voted early around the country. There's been 29 states where there's more early votes than total votes cast in 2014 in the midterm. All signals are pointing to very high turnout, if not presidential-level turnout, pretty close. Which is almost unprecedented in modern memory for turnout in midterm elections.
And what do you think that might portend for the results tomorrow?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, I think President Trump has been trying very hard to excite Republicans, really laying things on the line and trying to, you know, bring home the importance of it for him. It is very much a referendum on President Trump. And Democrats are just incredibly excited in ways that I had never seen in my lifetime. I've seen lots of elections where people are excited, you know, and then turnout goes up, maybe, but not so much, not so dramatically. There's signals that we might see historic levels of turnout, and that's probably bodes well for Democrats, though there's no guarantee in certain battleground, you know, districts or states that might be different.
And Sean Walsh, you're a former Republican strategist. What are you hearing about some of the early data that we're seeing in terms of the turnout?
Well, I agree that there's enthusiasm, but some of the turnout across the country from Republicans early is actually matching Democrats and in some respects even exceeding Democrats. Republicans tend to be pretty good with regards to absentee ballots and absentee voting. I think the real issue is going to be, and particularly here in California, does the mysterious youth vote, it's like the great pumpkin, maybe it's going to come up this year. Do they show up this year? And how many Latino voters actually show up and make the difference? And these races, particularly the California races that Nancy Pelosi needs to take the House, are just razor thin. So just a few percentage points from the youth and Latinos, I think, makes the difference in this election.
And typically, a president in power loses enthusiasm among his base. And in this case, it's, as you just said, Republican voters do seem to be engaged. Does it seem that they're abnormally engaged? And you know, if so, what do you attribute their engagement this cycle?
Well, it's worse than enthusiasm. So you go all the way back to the Civil War. There's only been two times in history where a sitting president in an off-year election did actually not lose seats in the House. It was Clinton and it was Obama. So, I mean, the tide in history is actually working against this president or any president sitting there. That said, Donald Trump is just an odd man. He's like dark matter in the universe of politics. It's out there, exists. It may destroy universes. It may affect things, but you just don't know how it works. And I will say something else here, too. I don't blame pollsters for getting things so wrong. The world has changed with cell phones and with computers and the types of polling. So figuring out what a voter is like in this election cycle and the tools that we have, and my colleague here is really the expert in here, and I defer to him, but is really, really hard. So you could actually see a Democratic blowout tomorrow, or you could see a narrow Republican victory. And CBS actually has numbers that show a very narrow pathway forward for Republicans that could hold the House by 5 seats.
That's exactly what they were saying 2 years ago also, right? They were saying the Democrats could blow out, and actually nobody expected it to be a close one, but of course the polls weren't really counting a whole lot of Trump voters.
Mm-hmm. So Ben Trefny, let me stick with you here. So I just asked other panelists about what we're seeing in terms of early turnout so far. What are you seeing here locally in the Bay Area?
Well, you know, I'm looking back over some of the notes from the San Francisco Department of Elections, and the turnout for the 2016 election in November was extraordinarily high, it seems. There was 80% voter turnout, which is remarkable. But just 2 years before that, it was 53%. So when we had the midterms back then, it was almost 30 percentage points below that. And so I think that, you know, voter turnout could be high. It seems like both sides are excited. But I'm wondering if some of our other panelists could talk to what a high voter turnout is going to portend. Maybe is that going to be better for Republicans or better for Democrats?
I mean, generally, you know, there's something that I keep thinking about in this regard, which is that generally Republicans are good voters, right? They're good at, you know, they tend to be older, they tend to be more educated, they tend to be more reliable, more habitual voters, right? And that's why it often, you know, portends, you know, Latino votes, young votes. These people vote less often on average. And yet President Trump's really relies on the kinds of voters that tend to be less reliable in midterm elections. And college-educated, you know, white voters are still more likely to support Republicans nationwide than Democrats. But Trump has, you know, eroded some of that support. And so I do think some of these signals are showing us that high turnout years, it's not that they always and everywhere high turnout affects is for the good of Democrats. But, you know, generally it's driven by competitive races. There are lots of competitive races. Democrats have expanded the map and are contesting 100, you know, over 100, probably 150 races around the country. I think high turnout is going to bode well for Democrats generally. Does not mean that they're going to take the Senate. I think there's just as much chance that the Democrats get, 50 to 60 seats in the House as the Republicans keeping their majority, right? Those are equally likely possibilities. It's going to be tough for Democrats to take the Senate, but I do think it'll be for the good of Democrats for the most part.
And John Walsh, what is your take in terms of – what's your prediction, I suppose, for tomorrow?
Well, my prediction is if the turnout in San Francisco for Nancy Pelosi is 70% or 90%, with all due respect – it doesn't matter. So if you have high turnout in high Democratic safe districts, you feel good when you're voting your bump, your sticker, and you take your selfie with your kids with your I voted sticker. But that's not meaningful. I will tell you, if there's going to be a surprise tomorrow, the surprise is how many suburban, most likely white, college-educated women do a protest against Donald Trump and won't show up to vote, or they show up to vote in one particular area, but they send a message in another. What I think people are not paying a lot of attention to, partly in California, but and particularly around the rest of the country, is there is a conservative Democrat voter, not a college-educated voter, who, you know, the Republicans were making these comments earlier, and Paul Ryan really kind of wanted them to keep to this message, which is, you know, jobs, not mobs. So historically, unemployment in the African-American community is the lowest it's ever been, as far as recorded history is. Latino unemployment is very, very low as well, and the economy is doing very well. So the Republicans wanted to see a push on the job issue, and some people are feeling fairly good, and some people really are repelled by Donald Trump's vulgarity, and he's a vulgar man, and he's vulgar every day in his tweets, but people are feeling fairly good from an economic perspective. So I wonder how many Democrats will actually play a meaningful role for these races at this time.
I got to say, presidential elections, the economy matters, right? We would think, though, that, maybe the good economy would matter this time around. And yet, for midterm elections, the theory tells us and the results tell us that it's really a referendum on the president. And this president is unpopular given the state of the economy. He is about 5 to 10 points lower than he should be. This election will be and is going to be a referendum on Donald Trump, and it's not going to be about the economy. It's going to be about his vulgarity, his style of governing. And I would say as well that any vote is meaningful, regardless of whether, you know, running up the margins in California is going to help Democrats nationwide. But any individual expressing their preferences, their vote is meaningful to them and to you know, their family, their friends. So I wouldn't want to diminish that.
All right. Well, let's get into some of the actual races here. I think this has been a helpful overview of what the early voting has to say, maybe for tomorrow's results. But certainly we've talked a lot about this voting tomorrow being a referendum on President Trump. But Bay Area voters do have a lot to focus on right here at home. For example, after a much lauded second act, who's going to be replacing Governor Jerry Brown? Will Dianne Feinstein be elected? Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf is also on the ballot, and we've got a number of propositions to cover. But let's first start with the U.S. House of Representatives, because as I mentioned in the opening, California does have a major role to play here if Democrats are going to take back the House. And what are we seeing in terms of these congressional elections? There are seven districts in California that went for Hillary Clinton, but also have a Republican running now, an incumbent Republican in the House. What are some of these hot races that we're seeing around the state? And Sean, let me start with you on that.
Well, I will say first and foremost, this is the most expensive or high dollar election in U.S. history. $5 billion now spent in this midterm election. California Republicans running for congressional houses are literally being carpet bombed with Democratic dollars. I haven't heard much about Citizens United in this race. When Mr. Bloomberg put $5 million into the race against Congressman Knight and another almost $5 million in the race against Mimi Walters, you've got Tom Steyer putting literally millions and millions of dollars into individual congressional races. So in some of these races in Southern California, Republicans literally are being outspent, which is rare as a sitting member, 8-1. That said, it's to me fairly remarkable that the Republicans are really in some of these races either 1 point ahead or 1 point down, particularly the Steve Knight race. It's remarkable that he's still hanging in there. He's been outspent, I think, almost 10-1.
And that's northern Los Angeles County.
Yes, that's out in Palmdale, Lancaster area. So the demographics have been changing, getting much more Latino oriented. When the housing market got really rough in L.A., a lot of people, more affordable housing moved up that way. So the demographics are changing. So we'll see. But I will tell you, from all of the races so far, Republicans are feeling good. You've got a member of Congress down there who, Duncan Hunter, has been indicted, probably will be convicted if what you're hearing is true, and is probably still going to win that race. You've got Dana Rohrabacher, who's just kind of an oddball duck. And so you're either going to get the B1 Bob Dornan treatment where he gets, you know, snuffed out of existence for just being too weird. But at this juncture, I'm not sure that they've
He's been in Congress forever, though. And Jesse Helms was in Congress forever, too, right? You get some oddballs who end up being in there for a long time. Just because,
and those are the kind of candidates time. That don't survive these kinds of elections, mm-hmm. right? You know, they're going to try to make these about local, local issues, and yet all of my research, and the political scientist says this is looking like a wave election where, when you have the president galvanizing attention this way, their efforts, they are doing a good job to be as close as they are, right? Mm-hmm. And they are, if they are being outspent, they're also being outraised, though, and a lot of these Democrats are outraising them on small dollar donations. That bodes ill for so many of these races where these incumbents are being outraised by their Democratic challengers, not just the independent money that was Mr. Walsh mentioned before. That bodes very poorly, I think, for some of these Republicans. Some might survive. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if one or two of them survive. I suspect, five of the seven will most likely lose.
I don't see it. I just don't.
So we'll find out tomorrow. But in the meantime, we do have a swing district, one of these closely battled districts going on right at our doorstep here in the Bay Area over in District 10, where Central Valley incumbent Jeff Denham is facing challenger Josh Harder. And a lot of Bay Area residents have contributed money to Josh Harder's campaign, over $1 million. And Ben, as you kind of take stock of what's happening in the Bay, are you hearing chatter about this Josh Harder, Jeff Denham race? What are you seeing in terms of the influx of Bay Area volunteers essentially going down there to try to help Josh Harder?
Absolutely. I know a lot of people who know people who are going down there to see what they can do. I mean, here in the Bay Area, it's so blue. And I think that, to your point, Sean, the vote that people make up here doesn't necessarily have national influence. But I think then you have a lot of people who are up here seeing where they can make that difference known. And when you have such a huge percentage of Democrats up here, they're going to go places where that's going to make a difference. That district, I think, is 45% Latino. So that goes to Sean's point also about we'll have to see how the Latino vote works out because that can make a difference in District 10. It is really, really close. I think that the last poll just saw Harder 2 points above Denham. And so that could obviously go either way.
And Jason McDaniel, what are you observing with this Josh Harder, Jeff Denham race?
The fact that the polls are showing, you know, Josh Harder with a slight lead is pretty amazing, right? Again, you know, Jeff Denham has not run a great race from what I've understood, but, you know, still an incumbent, you know, in that kind of district should be favored, and yet he's being outraised, he's being outspent. The Harder campaign has really done an effort to bring people from places like San Francisco to volunteer to help their get out the vote operation. I will say with a little bit of a moment of pride, one of my former students happens to be involved with the Harder campaign in that very thing. Not that I've, you know anything about the campaign at all, but that kind of effort when there are no races, when Pelosi is going to get reelected, when Jackie Spear is going to get reelected, the energy that people in San Francisco and in Oakland are showing by going out to some of these races around the state and in Nevada and Arizona, that's, I think, an expression of the kind of energy that California has right now.
Which reminds me of 2016 also, by the way.
And Sean, what do you make of this Josh Harder, Jeff Denham race and the influx of support from the Bay Area?
So I'm pointing to McCovey Cove right now, and I'm going to call a Babe Ruth home run. Mr. Denham is going to win this race, and he's going to win probably by 3 or 4 points. And I will tell you, much like after the Civil War, when a bunch of Northern Republicans went down and tried to help out the old Southern Democrats running for Congress down there, you show up in your you know, electric vehicles, and all these Bay Area people are showing up down there. And the reports I'm getting back are, it's like, wait a minute, you know, Nancy Pelosi and her minions are coming down here to run in this race, number one. Number two, I find it somewhat troubling that people tend to say, well, Latino votes are some monolithic vote. They're not. So you got agricultural workers that are in that district, and they work very, very hard, and they're different from an L.A. Latino vote, and they're different from a San Francisco Latino vote. And Denham has done a pretty good job. He was one of the few Republicans that went against the party for immigration reform and tried to have a pathway forward for the Dreamers and other folks. So I think he's well attuned to the Latinos in that district. I think he's doing a very good job, and I think from a campaign perspective, you have a boomerang effect where you think having hundreds of people from the Bay Area come up and knock on doors, they look at these people and say, man, you're not dressed the way I'm dressed. It's not helping, I think, in that race. So again, I think it's Denham's.
And what about the trade war that Trump started, all these taxes on agricultural goods? Is that going to hurt Denham's chances there among his agricultural base?
Well, I think actually the Democrats nationally have lost an opportunity to push that issue. I mean, California people think don't really realize that it's the number one agricultural state in the whole country. So they haven't really hammered on that issue. They tried to go on the health care. That's helped in some areas. I don't think it's as effective or important in that district. So, no, I don't think the Democrats have exploited that particular issue well enough in that district.
I want to say whether or not you're right about how this vote will go, Sean, I think that Babe Ruth would have hit a whole lot of homers into McCovey Cove if he played there.
Indeed.
Well,
indeed.
Maybe that's one thing we can agree on for sure. But since we're here in San Francisco, we have to ask about the potential next Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, right here. Ben, is there any reason to be concerned about her seat? What's that campaign look like, if it's looked like anything at all at this point?
Well, I'm not sure how long Nancy Pelosi's been in office, but she's been there for a whole lot of terms. I'm looking at all my fingers. I think she usually wins about 85% to whatever it is. So I haven't actually been looking at that race too closely. I think that her seat is safe.
And let's be clear, you know, she's the first woman Speaker of the House in the history of the United States, and she's going to, you know, most likely be the Speaker of the House again in January. And you know,
if they win,
I think that's the likelihood right now. And you know, despite the fact that Republicans have been trying to make her into a boogeyman for, you know, now well over a decade, right? Democrats are ahead nationally in the generic ballot. You know, they're ahead most of the polls in many of these toss-up, you know, close races. And again, some of these Republicans will win some of these close races. There's no doubt about that. But the efforts to make Nancy Pelosi into a villain have probably failed in that regard because of Trump. And I think she will most likely, and I think one of the most important aspects of this race for Congress is that there will probably be 100 women elected to Congress in this upcoming session. About 85 to 90 of those will be Democratic women. About 15 or 20 will be Republican. Most likely, Nancy Pelosi will be leading the most diverse, gender diverse caucus in the history of this country.
Well, two things I wanted to note on what you said there is, one is, if we learned anything from 2016, is we can't trust the polls. I think that we just can't trust the polls
at all.
I'm
going to disagree with that in a second, but okay.
Nationwide, I mean, that was something
the polls were pretty – the polls called a 3-point win for Hillary Clinton. She won the national vote by 2 points, right? Some of the states the polls were off. Some of the states they're closer. The polls performed pretty okay this last time around. I hear this from my students, and so that's why I wanted to interrupt. Polls can be off, right? Polls will be off. It's part of the way it works, right? And so I'm not saying this is all about polls. We look at historical data. We look at trends. We look at fundamentals, right? But so, again, I try to push back on people saying, well, can't trust the polls, because that's usually better information. And we have a lot of good polls to look at. There's no guarantees here, but they're sending a loud signal right now.
Well, so we could have a whole discussion about polling, which I hope
we do. The one other thing I wanted to note
that.
Is that one thing we could agree on for sure is that Nancy Pelosi, there's no question, she is a powerhouse for the Democrats. She's a huge fundraiser, and she's an important figure for them. Okay.
So this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight we're talking about the 2018 midterm elections tomorrow and what's important to Bay Area voters. We're joined by guest Ben Trefney, news director here at Local Public Radio KALW. Also joined by former Republican strategist Sean Walsh, principal at Wilson Walsh George Ross Consulting, and by Jason McDaniel, associate professor of political science at San Francisco State University. So we invite you to call in with questions or comments about tomorrow's election. Will you vote to reelect Dianne Feinstein, who I want to talk about in just a moment? Who do you want to replace Jerry Brown with? And in this pivotal election, did you go the extra distance to campaign, donate, or help fundraise for a cause or a candidate you believe in? What are the issues that concern you the most? The number to call to join this conversation is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. You can post a comment on kalw.org or follow us on Twitter at City Visions KALW. So, Sean Walsh, we were just talking about Nancy Pelosi, obvious shoo-in to get reelected. Questions remain about if there's a majority for her to lead as a speaker. But we have another potential shoo-in here based in San Francisco, and that's current Senator, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein. And she has a challenge from another Democrat, Kevin DeLeon, who's been a guest here on this program. What do you make of that race?
Well, number one, when I think Nancy Pelosi was first running in her first primary race and Dianne Feinstein, Christopher Columbus probably voted in that primary election. They've been around for a long time. They're establishment Democrats. And what I will tell you here and now is there is no race with Kevin DeLeon. Dianne Feinstein is a national prominent figure. Democrats here in the state realize that if I think by some miracle they take back the Senate in this race, she will have a major, major role to play as a senior senator from a majority perspective, and that's how the Senate works. I will make a prediction here, too. I will predict that Senator DeLeon does not even win his own Senate district back in Los Angeles in this race. There really, really isn't a competition. I think you see the way the one kind of quote-unquote debate they had at the Public Policy Institute of California wasn't really a debate. I think Mr. DeLeon decided to be the gentleman and look for his future political prospects. It's not a race. She's a shoo-in.
And Jason McDaniel, what do you foresee for Kevin DeLeon? What is he setting himself up for here?
You know, Dianne Feinstein is, I think, the most popular politician in California, and she's definitely going to win. Kevin DeLeon's candidacy was a sign of some of the dissent within the Democratic Party, or at least a signal of towards Dianne Feinstein that, you know, they wish she hadn't run, because she has been there so long, right? And there's so many Democratic candidates who are chomping at the bit to try to win that statewide office, right? So Kevin DeLeon has run that race. He's set himself up to be considered one of the, you know, the heir apparents, you know, next time around. He has not made mistakes in that regard, but he will not be the next U.S. Senator from California.
All right, we've got a question here from Ann Elizabeth in Mill Valley, who asks, in our state, how close does a vote need to be to either trigger a mandatory recount or allow the opponent to call for one? And do you expect many of these elections or measures to be called in the days or weeks after tomorrow's vote? So let's see, Sean, I'll throw that one to you. Do you know the election law and recounts? And secondly,
I've been involved in a number of recounts, and I should know this, so I'm punting to my academic professor friend over here. So,
I wish you hadn't done that.
While you're looking that up, it's
less than 1%, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, we could try to look that up, but I think that one thing is the Daryl Issa race, was it in 2016? That one went past Thanksgiving,
right?
The count on that. So We're going to be voting tomorrow, and Thanksgiving is about 3 weeks away or so. And so it's quite possible that in some of these close races, whether it's in Orange County or what I'm thinking of as Purple County now, maybe, or maybe in District 10, that these ones that could end up deciding whether the House is Democrat or Republican, those could end up going well down the line.
And so according to the website I just looked up, the Secretary of State's website, there is no law that triggers an automatic recount, right? It's up to the candidates to request them. So, you know, we'll see how if there's any that are close enough in that regard. And look, California takes a long time because they want to make it as easy as possible to vote. They want to get as many mail ballots in. You know, we have, you know, almost 40 million people, not that many voters. California is a major state. That's why it's going to take a long time. It is very possible that some of those races, if they are close, the control of the House may be up in doubt for weeks, if not longer.
And one other note on that, I looked up earlier today. I think that California, which is really pushing people to vote by mail increasingly, which ends up making for longer counts, I think that about 3/4 of the votes coming in California are by mail this year. Mm-hmm. That doesn't include mine because I actually have a vote by mail option, but I turn it in at the ballot box. I think that I'm just...
And that's an option for everyone who's got their
ballot. Traditionalist, I think.
Absolutely. All right, well, let's go to the phone lines. We've got Nancy from Berkeley calling in. Nancy, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. I wanted to know if anybody there had any information on the judges. We can't find any information on the judges. None of my friends could. Nobody. So people just didn't vote.
So a lot of us are probably struggling with that same question. So Jason McDaniel, what do you tell people in that situation?
I was just talking to a colleague of mine who is an expert on judicial elections. America is one of the only country in the world that elects judges like this. I tell people all the time, I don't know enough about these judges to elect them. But basically, I tend to vote if they're already the judge. I tend to vote for that unless they are talking about recall. I think generally. Judges. It takes a lot of money for them to run, but they generally are going to get reelected in that regard.
All right. And Ben, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, I wanted to say I want to apologize to you for not having more information at KALW about the judges. This is something that we talked about after the last election, how important the point that you made there specifically is, that this is something that we can't find information about. And yet, we got sucked into all these propositions. We've produced stories about 35 different ballot measures and propositions around the state and locally. And the one thing that really caught my attention about judges was in the last election that we had when the San Francisco Public Defender's Office attempted a takeover of the judges here in San Francisco. That one was pretty attention-grabbing because it was clearly a political move. But this time, I'm sorry to say that we haven't really done a lot of reporting on it. And next time, we'll do better.
So I'm going to be a contrarian. I think it's terrific that most people don't know much about judges because I don't think you really want political dynamics in most of your judicial elections. So if you've got a real problem with a judge, like the judge that let the person off for the sexual assault or rape and in
Palo Alto,
then that calls attention. It calls people's attention. But politics and the judiciary.
Yeah, no, I think I've definitely heard that from others as well. No news is good news when it comes to judges, but hopefully there's some
not listed in any of the booklets or anything. They're just they don't exist.
They're trying to run, and it's difficult for them. They're trying to maintain a sense of neutrality and even-handedness, and so they don't want to have to campaign for votes, at least in California. It's different in some states, like Texas, where they have much more robust judicial elections. I mean, again, frankly, as a professor of political science, we should not be electing these judges.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, Nancy, thank you for that question.
Sure.
I appreciate you calling in. And I want to go to Starchild from San Francisco. Starchild, welcome back to City Visions.
Hello.
Hi, Starchild. You there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Sure. What's your question for the panelists?
Yeah, well, just a couple comments. One, I heard you talking about Nancy Pelosi. It gets me that, her name comes up a lot, obviously, because she's the former speaker and maybe speaker again of the House. And nobody ever talks about how she hasn't. She's refused to debate her opponents since the first time she was elected in Congress way back in the '80s. Since then, she hasn't ever participated in the debate. It's anti-democratic, and I don't know why the media lets her get away with it. And kind of related to that, the issue of money in politics. I hear so much about this in the media. People bewailing, the influence of money in politics. But then, when media outlets cover the races and the candidates, they typically give more attention to the candidates and measures that have more money and more organization in their campaigns. I think it's very hypocritical. I think that media doesn't give a fair shake to alternative parties and independents and people with less money, and they don't talk about things like the fact that it costs $5,000 just to get on the ballot to run for mayor in San Francisco.
Yeah, no, Starchild, I think you raise important questions about the media, since we have a representative of the media here with Ben Trefney from our news bureau here at KLW. Ben, you want to respond to Starchild's comments?
Sure, and first of all, Starchild, I'm so glad that you're listening, because we talk with you every election season as a libertarian representative, and I know that you've been in touch with a lot of our reporters, and I really do appreciate that. And your point's well taken. I think that the thing is that the media often does follow itself. You know, if you watch the television news, it doesn't really matter what channel you're on. You're going to see the same story again and again, and you're going to see the same story in the same order. And this is just the way that the news media often works. I don't know exactly the reasons for it, but I can say that some of it might have to do with ratings. And so if you have things that get more people's attention, then this is a business for a lot of people. And so they will end up paying attention to the things that have more money. They'll pay attention to the things that are a little bit sexier. Here on KALW, we appreciate where you're coming from as much as we possibly can with the resources we have. So whenever there's candidates for mayor, for example, in Oakland, we'll interview every single candidate. A show like City Visions is going to try to speak with every representative they can on the issues that they have up front. So it's a challenge because of resources, and it's a challenge because of ratings, but I think that you're right.
I would say this, and this is, you know, a little bit of a contrarian view. I actually think part of the problem is all of the talk about that the money in politics is a problem. In fact, let's think about what we're getting for that money. Mr. Walsh said, I think, $5 billion spent on the election, and we're going to have record turnout. Right. What we're doing is we're buying democracy when we're spending that money on politics. Right. And the candidates that are covered are the ones that are getting the most support. Now, it's not always that way. Right. But money is another way of showing support. Now, it's not the best way, but it's one of the ways. And I think we're buying democracy. So let's not be so cynical about that all the time.
Yeah, it's an interesting point of view on that question. So this is City Visions on local public radio, not corporate public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco. Also on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're talking about the 2018 midterm election tomorrow, and what's important to Bay Area voters. We're joined by guest Ben Trefney from the news director right here at KLW, former Republican strategist Sean Walsh, principal at Wilson Walsh George Ross Consulting, and Jason McDaniel, associate professor of political science at San Francisco State University. We invite you to call in with your questions or comments about the election tomorrow, and that number to call to join this discussion is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. That's easier to remember, T-A-L-K. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment on klw.org, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisionsKALW. We have a question from Ainsley in Southern Marin, who says, looking beyond tomorrow's election, what impact do you foresee of California shifting its presidential primaries to March from our more traditional June? So, Sean Walsh, have you given some thought about what a changed presidential primary calendar for California might mean for election results going forward?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge, and it's particularly important for a guy like Michael Bloomberg, who's making noises that he's going to announce 2 days or 3 days after the election he's going to run. So a guy who's got a lot of money and can put a lot of money into a state that is historically very dependent on paid media advertising gives a guy like that a real leg up, number one. And number two, if you have now, I think there's 20, 25 Democrats who've expressed interest, including guys like Michael Avenatti, that they're going to run in the state. It makes it very hard, and it diffuses the $100 or $10 donations that you've seen in this election cycle. So I think it favors the very wealthy Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Jason McDaniel?
You know, I'm just old enough now that I've heard this kind of thing a couple of times. And, you know, I think there's reasons why the politicians want to move it, you know, earlier in the calendar. They think it'll maybe help, you know, some of the California candidates, especially someone like Kamala Harris. But that's usually not how it's going to work. I mean, most likely the field will be winnowed by the time that comes around. And California, you know, will have more of a say perhaps in the last couple of times. But it's still not going to be a game changer, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I want to go down through some of the propositions. It's a long ballot, and a lot of people have questions about the propositions in particular. Let's start a little bit out of order here. Let's go right to Prop 6, which we did a show on actually here on City Visions a month or so ago. It essentially repeals a 2017 gas tax passed by a supermajority passed by the legislature, which is used for road repair and public transportation. How much money we're talking about a significant amount of money here involved. And I would like to know from all of you what you see as the impact around this proposition. What are some of the debates playing out? And Sean, let me start with you on that, because I know that as a former Republican strategist, this has been a big issue for Republicans to try to turn out the vote.
Some would even say I'm a current Republican strategist, but I keep that quiet when I go on KAW. But what it means actually is a little over $5 billion a year in road repair and road construction. mentioned, it's a big, big deal. It was put on the ballot, I think, in some respects to help drive Republican turnout in this election cycle, as was the rent control to drive Democratic turnout. I think the people who were the geniuses that put it on the ballot, it didn't turn out that way. So right now, it could go either way, but it's probably going to lose, meaning that the gas tax would stay in place. So it's a pretty significant issue. Now, some people will say, well, you know, we put a tax on the tax. For gas, it's raised a lot of money. They don't deploy that money properly. There's good substantive policy arguments. But I'm telling you something, anybody who drives anywhere in this state, in the Bay Area, hitting potholes and crumbling stuff, I think that's it's not going to go down. It's not going to go.
It was just named the worst roads in the nation here in the Bay Area.
I think the fact that, you know, the people who have been, you know, working to defeat this, and it's most likely going to lose, have been focusing on roads and infrastructure. That's a very winning issue. But it's also about the future. And it's about climate change policy. And can the state pass even a moderate kind of modest tax on carbon? I mean, that's not the winning message. That's not the message that they've been using. But for me, I see this as the future versus the past. And we'll see where California chooses to go.
And also still, I was just on John Cox's website running for governor, and it's still basically the top mention on his site. So that speaks to the political purpose of why that's on there.
Sure. And Ben, since you just spoke up here, and I wanted to ask you a question about one of the propositions on the ballot, which is Prop 5, also known as the real estate tax. And basically, it would allow homeowners over the age of 55 who would be eligible for property tax savings under Prop 13 to basically be able to transfer that benefit with them as they move. And this is probably a big issue, I'm guessing, for a lot of folks here in the Bay Area. Given your role here at KLW, what do you hear chatter-wise around Prop 5?
Well, I think that, when I think of real estate in any kind of population that's maybe an older set, then I'm thinking of a lot of the politics that go into California on the whole. I mean, you think about Prop 13 and the way that a lot of voters don't want to have to pay any more for housing at all, especially if they're on fixed incomes or anything like that. And so this one seems to fit along those lines to me.
I mean, for me, this is at least the second time they're going to try to pass an extension of Prop 13. And it's very much, protecting wealthy people. This is, again, the future versus the past. And, for me, Prop 6 has taken up so much of the attention. This is one of the more important ones. And there's just nobody campaigning on either side, really. It could pass. I don't think it will, but it could. And again, that would be California, protecting a way of life that is about people who can own homes, who are already pretty affluent, who are older, rather than thinking about the future.
And I want to say also, according to fiscal analysis, here, schools and local governments each would lose over $100 million in annual property taxes early on, growing to about $1 billion per year. I mean, that really sounds like Prop 13 all over again. And there's been a lot of talk about changing Prop 13 around, even though I think that that's been a bit of a third rail in politics.
So let me just note here, someone emailed in with a comment that I want to just read out loud, because we just had that question from Nancy in Berkeley about the judges. And Martha from Berkeley says it's easy enough to get the judges' names off the sample ballot and then Google them. So that's Martha's advice. And I think, for those of you who are looking for more information, there's always the Googles on the internets to help out. And I want to go now back to the phone lines to Noah from Oakland. So, Noah, welcome to City Visions.
I had a question about Kremlin interference in the election. Is there any indication that the Kremlin will try to interfere with any races in California? And if so, is it enough to tilt the vote one way or the other?
So, all right, Noah, that's a question around the voter integrity here. Sean Walsh, what do you hear?
So the federal government has put a maximum amount of effort into making sure that this election is not interfered with. You've actually saw some reports earlier, not of the Kremlin, but actually of the Iranians trying to mess with the election process. You saw the Secretary of State making some noises over the weekend about the Democrats in Georgia trying to interfere with the election. They batted that back down away. So there's a lot of attention. I mean, it's maximum attention from the National Security Agency and others to make sure that, at least from a electronic voting perspective, that this election stays somewhat pure.
And Jason McDaniel, comment on the voter interference?
I don't think we need to worry about the integrity of the vote, especially from, foreign, sort of attacks or for anything like voter fraud, which is mostly a myth. But I will say this, the idea, I quibble with the term maximum effort. The president minimizes this. The president sends mixed messages. And the federal government, is a ship of state that's tough to steer sometimes. And, when the president is clear on something, that can have an effect. This president's not doing what he should be doing. doing in that regard.
Mm-hmm. All right. And a question about Prop 7, the daylight savings measure, since this is our first show without daylight savings time.
I was so happy about daylight savings this year, I've got to say. Yeah. Not that I'm going to vote one way or the other, but I was glad for the extra hour.
Well, so that's the question. A lot of people are wondering how this one got on the ballot and what's the benefit from passing this one. So
it's just stupid. Why do you have this on a statewide ballot? It's to give a sense to the legislature, who then has to do a two-thirds vote to pass it. Then they have to send it off to Congress. Congress has to pass it, and then the president has to sign it. And this would put us out of sync with 47 other states that has economic implications. I mean, it's just one of these things. It's California with the railroad barons and having the initiative process was great, but every now and then you get a little oddball knucklehead that makes you wonder why this is doing
that. More
than
every now and then in San Francisco and Berkeley and some of these cities too. Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they have, you know, major impacts. But yeah, this is the kind of thing that, you know, nothing will happen even if it does pass because Congress is not going to do anything. This is almost purely symbolic.
And it has to be a two-thirds vote, I think, to pass as well. So there'd be a lot of people who'd be for it. We were wondering in our newsroom today, how did it pass in Arizona in the first place?
Well, it's Arizona.
Yeah, Arizona and Hawaii do not follow daylight savings time.
Ask Senator Wannabe Sima about her views of Arizona. So anyway, it's a little bit of an odd state. Also, in fairness, I will say in different parts of the country, the actual sun rises and sets in a different way and timing, so that makes sense. Now, George Skelton, the kind of dean of the press corps in California, wrote a great article that basically said, if this did pass, you've got the sun coming up at the darkest period in December 21st at 8:32 or something in the morning. So, I mean, that really does actually affect school kids in a way. So I'm not sure it's dumb to have on the ballot, and I'm not sure it's good public policy anyway.
All right. Well, this is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. We're talking about the 2018 midterm elections and what's important to Bay Area voters, including daylight savings time. We're joined by guest Ben Trefney, news director here at Public Radio KALW, former Republican strategist and maybe current strategist Sean Walsh, principal at Wilson Walsh George Ross Consulting, and Jason McDaniel, Associate Professor of Political Science at San Francisco State University. We invite you to call in with your questions for our panels tonight. Panelists, the conversation to dial in is 1-866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org, or you can follow us on Twitter at City Visions, KALW. Let me go to an email from Arthur in San Francisco who says, I'm a Democratic Party voter, and I hope Gavin Newsom wins because his opponent, John Cox, would be a disaster. However, I'm appalled by Gavin Newsom's disappearing act in this election. He didn't even submit a candidate statement in the voter handbook. So he wants to know what the panelists here to have to say about Gavin Newsom not making himself available for scrutiny by the voters. Ben, do you want to field this question?
Well, I mean, California really is, I'm not sure what the percentage is of Democrats versus Republicans, but Gavin Newsom is not quite as much of a shoo-in as Nancy Pelosi, but I think that he's got an awfully good chance to become governor. And really, if you look at Gavin Newsom's history, and he started out as a supervisor here in San Francisco, and then he ran for mayor and he beat Matt Gonzalez in probably the closest race in which he's run, and then he went in to become lieutenant governor, you know, under Jerry Brown, and now, you know, moving into what seems like a sure thing as governor, he doesn't have his eye on the governorship so much. I think he has his eye on the presidency, actually, and he's been campaigning in a large way against Donald Trump. I think that the way that he has, what's it, the campaign for courage or something like that, he has written on his bus, he seems to be campaigning against Trump, and I think that that's what he'd be doing as governor of California also, looking to the future, except for I think that he'll wait his turn for Kamala Harris.
And Jason McDaniel, do you want to weigh in on the Gavin Newsom?
This is something where, you know, having a non-competitive election and the sort of shambles of the statewide Republican Party and hurts us. You know, we're better off, and I think Gavin would be better off if he had to run a strong campaign. He would be closer to the voters. This might hurt him going forward when he runs for re-election, right? No, I doubt it, right? But it's possible if the economy goes down, if something happens to damage his approval ratings, not having been out there running a strong campaign might hurt him in the future.
I'm wondering, Jason, I mean, you've watched Gavin Newsom over this time too. It seemed to me when he was a supervisor, he wanted to be president. Do you think that this has kind of been his path?
You know, it's interesting. I think that I agree with you. You know, that kind of passion in him, and the idea of someone who was, you know, a Clinton-esque sort of very charismatic, you know, white guy who could appeal to moderate Republicans. I think that was a vision that was very popular in the 90s. That's not where the Democratic Party is right now. I would be very surprised if the Democratic Party was open to someone like Gavin Newsom. That being said, he is very liberal, you know, in tune with the Democratic Party in that regard. So, yeah, I would be surprised. But I suspect Kamala Harris is going to have a go at it before Gavin Newsom.
I want to say also, interestingly, to me, for somebody who has such political aspirations, he's a chance taker. You know, he has had his finger on the pulse a little bit ahead of the rest of the country when it comes to same-sex marriage, when it comes to cannabis legalization.
Gun control is another one of those.
Well, Sean, I want to work you in here, too. What is your assessment of the Newsom-Cox race?
So, well, I agree. California is more and more a one-party state, and I don't think that's actually healthy because you don't get competing ideas. You pretty much get stale ideologically and policy-driven ideas. Two things I think worth note. Number one, the interesting thing is you've got Steve Poizner, who's running for insurance commissioner. He's not running as a partisan Republican as he was once before. I think it's highly likely that he wins that race. And is this a canary in the coal mine that California is going to look a little bit differently at no-party preference candidates or other things? I don't know. Possibly, number one. Number two, I would caution Mr. Newsom, as a guy who worked as Deputy Chief of Staff in Governor Wilson's administration and Senior Policy Advisor for Governor Schwarzenegger, that California has a bad habit of, when the economy turns down, our tax system is so heavily dependent on the top 1% that the world comes crashing down upon you, and it is a five-alarm fire to manage the budget problems here in California. And so, running for president in New Hampshire when you have a $30, $40, $50 billion deficit, and you got to cut back on health care funding for, you know, poor people, it has a tendency to be sobering for you.
So talk about a dark dawn. If when the economy crashes here in California, absolutely, the fiscal picture looks pretty bleak. Let's go to Nicole from San Francisco calling in. Nicole, welcome to City Visions.
Hello. I was calling in about the two propositions, Proposition 5 and 7, I believe. Because I have a dissenting viewpoint from you guys, and I wanted to explain why.
Want to hear it.
Okay. Proposition 5, I'm going to start with that. Basically, San Francisco is going to come out ahead on Proposition 5. And the reason is that the elders, and I'll give an example, and I am lucky enough to have inherited my home from my school teacher parents who bought the house in 1966. And if it were not for Prop 13, which we were not for, incidentally, I was too young to vote, but my parents were not for it because we've always been liberal voters. But reality is that a normal middle-income individual cannot stay. I would never be able to afford the property taxes on my house, let alone my home. And I live in Coal Valley, which is a really expensive neighborhood, which in 1966 was a marginal neighborhood. It was not a desirable neighborhood. But anyhow, when people like me, I have no desire to leave the city, but other people who have not left the city, because, like, say their
Nicole,
children...
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to make sure we have time for other callers and issues, and I just was hoping you could just kind of state what you think is a challenge with Prop 5.
I'll try and do it quickly. But the new people buying are going to be paying much higher property taxes.
So basically you're saying it's going to lead to some turnover and increased taxes. So Sean has a response to that.
You're absolutely right. So, I mean, the public employee unions and some of the local governments don't like this, but I think there's a very credible mathematical calculation that shows that with Prop 13, the taxes start at what your purchase price is. So if you're actually going down market to a much smaller house, and you're churning the property, I think there can be an argument made that you will actually make more money. And she's actually right. In San Francisco, you'll probably make quite a bit more money. If you're Riverside, San Bernardino County, it's, you know, unclear. But there is a fiscal argument to be made that that's correct.
Yeah, let's let the millionaires make more money. That's
also
what we need to do here.
They're also going to be putting money, these old people that say, I'm going to use Contra Costa as an example. Their kids priced out of the city, bought in Contra Costa. They sell their house in San Francisco. Francisco. They're able to help their kids.
And let me give you another real important policy argument is when you sell that house and you free up cash, then people tend to use that cash for their living, health care, et cetera. And so that's money that actually isn't then burdened upon other governmental entities.
But let's be clear. This isn't going to raise taxes. This is going to raise her taxes. This is going to be about if she wants to sell her home and buy a new one, right? So I'm sorry. This is ridiculous. This is about giving a benefit, subsidizing millionaires and their homes, and it's about the past versus the future.
All right. So now, Nicole, I'm going to have to cut you off because we have a whole bunch of issues to get to. But I really appreciate you calling in and stating your opinions on this. And I want to ask the panelists because we have a whole bunch of other propositions we haven't covered. So, Ben, let me just turn it over to you. Are there other propositions that you're watching that you think are worth talking about here on the program that the listeners should be aware of that, you know, might be a close or otherwise significant proposition battle coming up?
Well, Proposition 1 is another one that has to do with housing. And, you know, this would authorize the sale of $4 billion in bonds that finance many existing low-income housing programs. And a quarter of that money would go to help veterans purchase homes, mobile homes, and farms. This is money that proponents say has been funding that's been diminishing over time, but the opposition to it wants that kind of thing funded privately rather than with more bonds. I think that the question for a lot of people is, can the state get away with passing more bonds that maybe would have trouble paying off. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting one to me.
And Jason, same question for you. What propositions are you monitoring?
For me, it's Prop C locally in San Francisco. You know, it looks like it's going to pass. The politics of it has been fascinating.
And can you describe Prop C?
So Prop C is about raising taxes on some of the larger corporations in San Francisco to fund a very substantial, probably about $300 million spending on homeless services and housing for homelessness. Strong support in the city, strong support by most of the politicians in the city, except for the mayor, Scott Wiener, and David Hsu. You know, Dianne Feinstein's been in favor, Nancy Pelosi, et cetera. It's going to pass most likely, but will it pass by enough of a margin to avoid getting into a lawsuit is an open question. But that is the city really taxing itself, or at least taxing some of the corporations there, to fund homeless services. It could be a massive change to the policy there.
And it's interesting. Ben, your take on the property.
Thank you. I was just going to say that it's interesting because that sort of turned into this Benioff versus Breed argument with Mark Benioff saying that he supports Prop C. But Breed, when she wrote a letter explaining her opposition to Prop C, she was saying that there's problems with accountability. I mean, there's a lot of money put into homeless services in the city of San Francisco, and this would almost double that, but without specific directives on how to use that money. And she wants to see the whole city to be accounted, to have its accounting done for its homelessness issue.
Okay, San Francisco currently in the last budget was an $11 billion budget. It spends over $300 million for services for the homeless, $300 million. I mean, almost every other jurisdiction in the country would salivate over that, and there's estimated between 7,000 and 7,500 homeless people. I think Mayor Breed has a very, very good point to make. Get a policy in place, start executing on that. If that works, then go to the voters.
I would say this, though, that it's actually most of that money is being spent on people who are already being housed, right?
And it's for supportive housing.
Right. Well, that's already been done, right? And so this will be new money to affect people who are not housed, right? And Mayor Breed does support more money on homelessness. And her argument is one that mayors make those kinds of arguments, and they're valid arguments. I think if she had known that Mark Benioff was going to come out in support of it the way he has, she might not have come out and opposed it the way she has. And I think her opposition has been pretty muted since then.
So Prop C is a city ballot measure, but I was asking about state measures, although I'm glad we covered Prop C because that was worth discussing. But Sean, I never gave you a chance to talk about the state initiatives that you're following.
So real quick, on Proposition 1, $4 billion, it's nice, but really we're producing less than half of the actual housing units that we actually need to house our incoming population. This is literally the proverbial drop in an ocean of necessary needs. I would argue that if the legislature got its act together and the governor and reformed the California Environmental Quality Act, some certain prevailing wages for low-income housing and other issues, you would have a multiplier effect that is much, much larger than
that. So you mean to like smooth out the environmental review process for development?
Yes. I mean, in many respects, look, I respect labor, but as often as the case, they will use CEQA for project labor agreements that slows down housing construction around the state.
So you're assuming that CEQA is the main cause of our housing shortage, not local zoning, local permitting processes?
All of the above. I mean, let me tell you something. If you can get a CEQA exemption and get the Golden State Warriors Stadium built like a rocket sled – through the thing, then you can find affordable housing in different jurisdictions. I mean, it's a shame. Every sports
That's
stadium,
if affordable housing were being funded by billionaires who own really popular sports teams.
So,
and Sean, I have to ask you another question that came in from an emailer, Skylar and Marin, on the subject of state ballot measures. And Skylar asks, are there any state ballot measures outside of California that you're keeping an eye on that can maybe find their way here or have a direct impact on our state? And Jason, I'm happy to turn it to you afterwards. Or Jason, if you want to answer now, go ahead.
You know, I'm not an expert on lots of other states, but there's one in Florida about enfranchisement of, you know, people who have served their time in prison. That, to me, as someone who's interested in voting rights, is a really important one to watch.
Mm-hmm. All right. Great. And then, Sean, going back to you, we've talked about some of the state propositions now, but I want to ask you about state races. So we talked a bit about the governor's race. Any other statewide office holder elections coming up that you've been tracking and want to comment on?
I'm going to tell you that there's been so much money on the congressional races and so little money and attention on the other races. If you're an incumbent, you're winning. So Becerra is going to win. I guess maybe the interesting race is the lieutenant governor's race potentially. I'm not sure where that's going. But again,
that's with Eleni Kunalakis and current state senator Ed Hernandez.
Yes. So my gut tells me that Kunalakis wins insofar as that she's got a substantial donor base. She's put a lot of ads up. She's got Obama stuff. She's got Obama relationships. So she's leveraging that. So, but again, I mean, this is really, it's a sleeper for all the statewide constitutional offices.
Mm-hmm. All right. And Jason McDaniel, statewide offices that you're monitoring.
I think Sean did a very good job of covering that, right? There's some assembly district races that maybe, deserve some attention. I think there's one locally, Beckles versus Buffy Wicks, that is going to come down to the wire. But generally, I think this election is about the House and the Senate, and nationally, much more so than California.
There is one very, very important issue, which is the Democrats right now have a strong potential to have supermajorities in both the Assembly and the State Senate. I would argue that's a really bad thing because then virtually any balance going away from what the Democrats want to ram through all the way through is basically gone. So the real issue, and that's the secret issue, is these Assembly and Senate races. If you can keep some semblance of balance there to try and keep one side from just ramrooming everything through, that's the secret
issue. And right now, I think it's just one Assembly member off from a supermajority.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And it has been a supermajority before there was somebody left office.
And Ben, real quick, because we're getting short on time here, are there local district supervisor races that you're tracking that you think are worth commenting on?
Yeah, I actually live out in District 4 in San Francisco, and Katie Tang unexpectedly decided to leave office, but she has been part of a chain of people who have basically handed that position off from one to the next. From Katie Tang, before her was Carmen Chu, before her was Fiona Ma, before her was Leland Yee, who's actually in prison right now. But Katie Tang has pushed forth her legislative aide, Jessica Ho, who a lot of people have been complaining is more of a Los Angeles resident than a Sunset one, and we've had issues with that there also. But she's running against Gordon Marr, whose brother was also a supervisor in the city. So that's an interesting race, and I think that Jessica Ho would probably have the upper hand because of that chain I talked about, but Gordon Marr is an interesting choice also.
All right, so some local elections to follow, and so we got to wrap it up here, but I want to ask each of you to tell listeners what you're going to be looking for tomorrow. Are there any bellwether races, results that you're going to track, and if any final predictions on what's going to happen? So Jason McDaniel, I'll go to you.
Well, just quickly, I'm looking locally at the District 6 race. I think it's going to be really close between Matt Haney, Sonia Trauss, Christine Johnson. That's what I'm looking at for me. I think it's going to be the closest one. And then nationally, frankly, I'm going to be looking at Texas and the Senate race in Texas, right? I think the House is going to be pretty clear. But if the Democrats can win, Texas, you're going to see a big changeover.
And Sean Walsh, same question for you. What are you looking for tomorrow?
I think it's the Senate. So if you look at North Dakota, if you look at Indiana, if you look at Missouri, if you look at Florida, those are kind of going to be bellwethers. Actually, if Republicans turn out fairly big, particularly in the southern races, then the Midwest, then I think that could portend good things for Republicans. If they get blown out, then I think you're looking at potential wave as opposed to what I call blue tornadoes. I think you're going to see some blue tornadoes in congressional districts around the country, but I don't think you're going to see a blue tidal wave.
And Ben Trefney, last word for you. What are you looking for tomorrow in terms of the results?
Well, one thing that we didn't really talk about was what's going on in Oakland. And, of course, there's a mayor's race in Oakland. I think that Libby Schaaf is probably going to win. She's the incumbent. And she actually gained some name recognition nationally earlier this year when she basically took on Donald Trump. And I think that she was the recipient of one of his famous tweets. But Libby Schaff just is about to lose the Raiders, and maybe for a lot of Raiders fans, I say good riddance at this point. But also, she's struggling with so much homelessness in Oakland, and I think the solutions that she's coming up with are not that solid. So there's a potential competitor in Kat Brooks, maybe Saeed Karamuz, and I don't know how far they're going to get with this, but it's going to be interesting to see what percentage of votes Libby Schaff gets.
All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there, and you can all tune in tomorrow on election coverage to find out exactly what happened and if these, any of these predictions have come true. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Ben Trefney, KLW Public Radio News Director.
Thank you very much.
And Sean Walsh, Principal at Wilson Walsh George Ross Consulting. Thank you for being here, Sean.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Jason McDaniel, too, Associate Professor of Political Science at San Francisco State University.
Thank you.
And, of course, thank you all for joining us this evening. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe, and tonight's show was produced by Jen Ruick. This is Ethan Elkind. Thanks so much for listening. Good night, and have a great rest of your week, and don't forget to vote tomorrow.